Aren't you glad you're a Christian? Beautiful spring day and a beautiful church family. All right, memory verse, 1 Corinthians 15, 20, and 21. Let's say this together. But now Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who are asleep. For since by a man came death, by a man also came the resurrection of the dead. Amen. Money seems to be pretty important to us. For example, in our culture, we have all of these sayings and idioms about money. Money talks. Some of you are like, the only thing it ever says to me is goodbye. Money doesn't grow on trees. I'm sure most parents have used that one. If I had a nickel for every time a day late and a dollar short, bet your bottom dollar. That cost a pretty penny. They're a dime a dozen, making money hand over fist. It's not going to break the bank. I feel like a million bucks. He's got money to burn. He's a penny pincher. He's worth his weight in gold, and there are many, many others. And we're often fascinated by the rich and famous. Now, here's a graphic somebody made of the richest people in 2021 and how it changed through the pandemic. That was actually from January, and so it's a little different now. But as you can see, I'm no longer on the list. They intrigue us, and so we read articles and books, and we watch shows and movies about these people who, in one way or another, either through hard work or just dumb luck, became extremely rich. And we often dream of what it would be like if we were rich. You know, instead of worshiping in this old church building, we could be worshiping on my super yacht. That'd get attendance up. All right, if you would, let's be turning back to the book of James. We're now in chapter 5. Earlier in the book, James spoke of the rich fading like a wildflower in the heat in chapter 1. And he also accused the rich of exploiting Christians, dragging them into court, and blaspheming the fair name by which they are called in chapter 2. But that is actually very mild compared to what James said about the rich in this section. It was obviously a real problem in his day. Now, there is nothing inherently sinful about being wealthy. Riches, they are only evil when they impair someone's spiritual health. There's nothing wrong with having money or even having a lot of money. God blessed Job and Abraham and David with lots of wealth, and they were definitely heroes of faith. As Dave Ramsey likes to say, money is amoral. It's like a brick. A brick can be used to build something or to hold something down, or it can be thrown through a window or used to hit someone over the head. The brick doesn't care. The same is true with money. The problem is the love of money and the obsession to get rich. It's the way that we view it, acquire it, and use it. And prosperity can very easily lead people into a sense of self-sufficiency and thus away from God. It can also cause our hearts to be wedded to this world, or as some people put it, welded to this world. Now, because that is true, there are all these exhortations in Scripture that warn us about accumulating a lot of money. For example, Jesus spoke of the difficulty of the rich being saved in Matthew chapter 19. That was the eye of the needle statement. I mean, the Bible certainly doesn't hold to the common human assessment that riches are always good and poverty is always bad. When looking at the Bible, we might say there are four kinds of people. Those who are rich in the world's goods, but poor toward God, like the rich fool in Luke chapter 12. Those poor in the world's goods, but rich toward God, like Lazarus in Luke 16. those poor in the world's goods and poor toward God, like the prodigal son before he came to his senses in Luke 15. And those rich in the world's goods and rich toward God, like Abraham in the book of Genesis. And I've certainly come across all four of these different ones, these different people. I'm sure you have as well, these categories. So, which category are you in? Now, our passage for today, it's mainly concerning these first two categories, the ungodly rich and the godly poor. Now, some people see this section in James as kind of like a court case. So verse 1, it reveals how the ungodly rich should feel because of the charge that's against them. And then verses 2 through 6, it lays out the case against them, the evidence. So verse 1, it says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries which are coming upon you." Now again, this is not every rich person. This is a certain class of rich people. So we can see from verse 6 that they had condemned the righteous man. And so this is probably not speaking of wealthy Christians, but rather those who are mistreating Christians. So I think this section is primarily here to encourage those poor Christians who are being afflicted and to discourage them from being envious of those with money and power, which is very easy to do. I want that yacht. But this could certainly apply to any Christian who might fall into this. All right, weep and howl. That's obviously suggesting the expression of utter woe. And miseries refers to the wretchedness of their circumstances. This is the exact opposite of what they're probably thinking and what they would probably expect. I mean, why should we weep and howl? Things are great. I mean, life is just one continual party, and we're insulated against any troubles, any problems by what we've accumulated. Those hard times are nothing for us. As in the 80s song, "I don't worry because my wallet's fat." And of course, in their eyes, their net worth establishes their self-worth. But if they truly understood their fate, they would literally shriek at the prospect. So James, he laid out the details of this court case. He laid out the evidence against them. All right, Exhibit A, verses 2 and 3. "Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure." And this immediately brings to mind what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6. "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So James began by painting this picture of the true condition of their wealth, this wealth that had taken hold of their hearts and their affections. And maybe as it's seen from God's perspective, their riches were rotted, moth-eaten, and rusted. Now, rust is certainly something that my family is familiar with since we used to live right by the ocean before we moved here. Metal, it does not survive very long in the salty ocean air. Now, obviously, gold and silver, they don't actually rust. That's the oxidation of iron. But I believe the Greek word that's used here could also be used for something being tarnished, which certainly can happen to gold and silver in different ways. But I suspect he's just using it figuratively. He's just using figurative language to make his point. See, they expect their gold and silver to be around forever. But you can't put your trust in it. It cannot deliver the permanence that it promises. And it certainly won't be able to help them out of the coming miseries. You might recall Jesus' statement about the deceitfulness of riches in Matthew 13, 22. It's not what you think. Alinsky made the comment, "The verbs James uses are figurative. wealth does not rot, nor do fine garments actually become moth-eaten. Rich people take good care of them. As far as these rich are concerned, as far as these things are supposed to make them rich, these things are like a lot of rotten, moth-eaten, rusted stuff that deserves to be thrown out. People who have nothing better are the most wretched beggars. Their gold and their silver are like iron that is rusted through and through or rusted clean away. Well, James, he then said that it's this corroded condition of their wealth that will stand in judgment to testify against them. See, their unused hoarded and their corroded riches would take the stand to testify against them. Now, some people think the point is that they were rotting from being unused. And maybe the stockpiles of their grain comes to mind. And for the rich man in Jesus' parable in Luke chapter 12, he didn't know what to do with all of his extra grain. He didn't know where to put it. It was quite the dilemma. Well, how about the mouths of the orphans, widows, and truly needy in his community? How about using some of it in the support of God's work? No, he never saw past himself. James, he said, the testimony is, it's so condemning that it will consume your flesh like fire. And he may have been painting the picture of the rust spreading, this rust spreading from the gold and silver onto them, and with such fierceness, the fierceness of fire. You know, rust and fire, they're known for their destroying power. And of course, fire is often used as a judgment figure to depict the ultimate end for those who are not, as James 2:5 says, rich in faith and love God. As I've heard it put, the testimony of the evidence will be so damning that you might say it lights the fire of their punishment. James, he also showed the folly of this mad pursuit of wealth, because it is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. So what does that mean? All right, well, some people, they think that this is speaking of the last days of Judaism, and it's referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Many of the rich Jews who had oppressed their Christian brethren, they certainly did weep and howl during that time as they were defeated and killed by the Romans. But I think the last days, it's just talking about the Christian age. As Peter said in his Pentecost sermon in Acts chapter 2, he quoted from Joel, which spoke of what would happen in the last days. This is the last period of time for God's creation. The next great event in the universe is going to be the second coming of Christ and then the judgment day. And since judgment could come at any moment in the last days, it is very foolish to waste all of our time pursuing what is only temporary and that wears out. These rich people, they had stored up earthly stuff as if they would live forever on this earth and that they would be able to use it forever. And of course, we're reminded again about the rich fool in Jesus' parable. He had so much wealth that he had to tear down his barns and build bigger ones. And yet he died on that very night. What was the use of all his wealth to him then? Well, Orbison gave the illustration. If you could accumulate all the food in the world, that would not guarantee that you would eat breakfast in the morning. These rich had not used their resources wisely. They were greedy and self-absorbed. But finally, the day of reckoning will come to them. All right, Exhibit B, verse 4. Let's continue reading. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Now, as you know, the Bible is just filled with passages and statements that talk about honesty and integrity and justice. Now, mowed your fields, that's just a way of speaking of doing the reaping. not the neighbor boy pushing his lawnmower. In the season of reaping, see, landowners, they could make a small fortune. And this made their crime of withholding the wages of the workers even more shameful. It's not that they didn't have the money to pay them. Rather, they were greedily keeping that money for themselves, those funds just for themselves. So how could they justify doing this? I don't know. Perhaps there were trumped up charges against the workers, or they found some legal loophole, or maybe the landowner was just conveniently out of town on payday, or they only gave them part of the money and promised to give them the rest later. As it's been said, there are no limits to the creativity of the greedy. Now, whatever it means, these guys were lining their pockets with the livelihood of the poor. And as you know, there are plenty of people who are doing that today. They are getting rich through dishonest and underhanded means and at the expense of others. Hopefully that's not you and me. Now, if these were rich Jews that he was referring to, well, then they had disregarded the demands of the law of Moses. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens. Speaking of a foreigner, not little green men, who is in your land, in your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he may not cry against you to the Lord and it become sin in you. For the really poor people, if they didn't receive pay at the end of the day, they did not eat. And so the Jews were not allowed to retain the wages of the hired workmen for even one night. All right, maybe they thought they had gotten away with it. But James said it's these withheld wages that cry out against them and testify against them. As Abel's blood shed by his brother Cain cried out to God from the ground. Genesis chapter 4. Now, on top of that, the outcry of the workers themselves has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Not Sabbath, Sabaoth, or hosts, speaking of armies. All right. This name refers to God's ultimate control over all of creation and the fact that everything is at his disposal to use, whether that is an army of men, locusts, angels, whatever. It was often used in the Old Testament to speak of God's power, especially in bringing punishment. See, these rich people, now they're not going to listen to the entreaties of the poor whom they're defrauding, but God will. And those who deprive the poor of their hard-earned wages, they are no match for this one whom they must ultimately give an accounting. And guess what? He doesn't take bribes. The rich, they thought that they could cheat these workers and get away with it because the poor, they often don't have anyone to defend them. But on the contrary, the defender of the poor is the Almighty. And he hears their cry and he will grant them justice in the end. And so everyone needs to ask the question, is that bit of money unfairly obtained worth the ultimate cost? Okay, Exhibit C, verse 5. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. As Robert said, the wages fraudulently kept back were used to live luxurious and self-indulgent lives, thus adding to the flagrance of their crime. The expression on the earth is possibly James's way of indicating that this condition is temporary. Only on earth, and not for long here, will this indulgent use of ill-gotten gain last. We will take with us neither our money, 1 Timothy 6:7, nor the pleasures it buys. I heard about a wealthy family where one of the members was dying and the possible heirs were all waiting very anxiously. And after the man said his last words and breathed his last breath, his doctor and his lawyer were coming out of his room. And one of the more outspoken family members went up to the lawyer and said, "What did he leave?" And the lawyer said, "He left everything. He didn't take anything with him." He knew what they meant. Now, their life of wanton pleasure, it paints this picture of wasteful self-indulgence, while those they had cheated do without. So again, the problem is not having wealth, but living this kind of life by means of ill-gotten gain. And then there also seems to be implied the problem of the way that they were using it. Because wanton, it means unrestrained and excessive. Obviously, if your neighbor's kids are starving and you are taking a milk bath every night in your solid gold bathtub, well, there's a problem. And so it's not just the way they got it. It's the way they used it, simply for fleshly self-indulgence. If we just live for the here and now, our lives, they're not pleasing in the sight of God. See, Paul, he told Timothy to instruct the rich to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. This life is not life indeed. And so we better not live as though it is. Now, the day of slaughter, it's an expression probably depicting the day of God's judgment. And the idea of fattening your hearts, it might bring to mind our modern feedlots, where cattle, they're fed to put on as much weight as possible before being sold at auction for slaughter. Now, it's as if these rich were preparing their hearts for the judgment of God. They're preparing for a destiny of slaughter. They're like cattle in a feedlot. They're just enjoying the good meals and their lavish and lazy lifestyle, completely unaware of what's coming. Hamburgers. Yes, they are riding in first class, but the destination is not a vacation. And so we've seen the problem of hoarding treasures, defrauding measures, and indulging pleasures, but that's not all. Exhibit D, verse 6. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. And this is the climax of their sins. Well, some think that James was referring to Jesus as the righteous man that they condemned and put to death. Now, it was the rich and powerful who did that, but because of verse 7, I think he's just talking about Christians in general. Well, put to death, that may refer to the fact that since the wages are being withheld, well, these poor, they're condemned to die because they're not able to buy the things that are necessary, that they need. Or he could be saying that the righteous would not get justice in a court of law when opposed by these rich. See, in chapter 2, verse 6, James mentioned that the rich would drag the Christians into court. And the rich could very easily use their influence and or their money to bribe the judge in order to sway a decision in their favor. But again, just because you get away with something on this earth, that doesn't mean you actually got away with it. Now, we might think of Ahab and Jezebel in 1 Kings chapter 21. That was where they, in their getting Naboth's vineyard. They used their power and their influence to wrongly get poor Naboth executed. But God saw it, and he sent his prophet to Ahab. Now, you ought to read that sometime. Now, again, I think righteous man, speaking of a Christian being defrauded by these rich, or the ones who are not followers of the Lord, and perhaps he does not resist because he cannot. But if you think about it, a Christian is actually a very easy target. It's an easy person to cheat and to treat badly because Christians are taught things like turning the other cheek, praying for their enemies, not taking their own revenge, stuff like that. We find passages like 1 Peter 2, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. There have been plenty of people throughout time who have tried to take advantage and exploit that. So James presented to the judge and jury the evidence that demands only one verdict. Guilty. Case closed. And so as has been said, we hear the echo of the gavel as the verdict rings throughout the universe. In verse 7, the exhortation is given. Be patient, therefore, brethren. And so he went on to change the subject matter from those afflicting to those afflicted. His poor Christian brethren. That'll be for next week. But, okay, here's the thing. If you think about it, compared to most people in the world, either those who are living now or who have lived in the past, most 21st century Americans are very blessed and could very easily be considered rich. Holloway made the argument. With his strong language against the rich, one wonders what James would think of the wealth of the typical American church member. Most of us reject the charge that we are rich. The rich are those with more than we have. As a student of mine once said, in all sincerity, we're not rich. We live in a two-story house. Rich people have three-story houses. Look, historically, we live at a level of luxury and abundance that only kings and queens could imagine. If our internet connection starts going slow, or we hit too many traffic lights, or it takes more than 5 minutes to get our fast food, boy, we are going looking through the Bible trying to find all the verses on suffering, right? We have got it pretty good. The United States has had the world's largest economy since, get this, 1871. Look that up later. There is a reason why all of these people want to immigrate to America, either legally or illegally. We just need to make sure this section could not be applied to us. So that's our challenge for this week. Take a good look at our lives. Because often the more we have, the more we want. And soon, if we're not careful, well, we're cheating others and we're breaking the law and we're hoarding our money and we are failing to use it for good. Again, money is not the problem. It's the love of money. It's greed. And keep in mind that poor people can be just as greedy as rich people. We always need to ask, what is the ultimate ambition and goal of my life? And does it make sense for me to live the way that I'm currently living when life is so short and there's going to be a judgment day? May we never forget about the rich fool. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.